You're listening to the Dismantling Normal podcast. I'm Megan Schaefer, and when my perfectly curated normal life blew up and took my standard list of checkboxes with it, I reevaluated everything. I stopped hustling for my worth and found freedom in coloring outside the lines. Join me for authentic, curious conversations that unravel the baggage, bias, and distance our perceptions of normal create. Let's find out what happens when we stop being normal and start being real. Okay, here we go. Hi, everybody. Thanks for being here. I'm used to sending my words out into the world, but not with my voice attached, so this is a little different. I'm going to have to edit this later, and I'm going to hate it. I'm doing a podcast because I love the sound of my own voice, said no one ever. But that does bring me to my point, actually. This is the inaugural-ish episode of Dismantling Normal, my new podcast dedicated to finding out what happens when we dig through our layers of normal and start being real. And I'm here to give you the why behind it, a little glimpse into the shit show that started it all. I'm a little late on this, but before we go any further, a PSA in case you've got kids around. This podcast and this episode in particular contains mature subject matter and language. If this is your first ever podcast, rock on. Welcome. Ask questions. Some of you are going to find the idea of never having listened to a podcast wild, and others will be glad I'm acknowledging it. And that's kind of how this podcast is going to roll. Some of you will think the discussions are a little much or unnecessary or maybe even absurd. But others are finally going to let out the breath they've been holding because someone's talking about it out loud. And you might trade off from one camp to the other from time to time. I just ask that you sit back and stay open and listen to the people so willing to bravely honor us with their stories. If I've learned anything, it's that when someone tells you their experience, pay attention and believe them. Awful, amazing, courageous, heartbreaking. It looks different for everyone, but it feels the same. And that is where empathy lives, and that is where we connect. So enjoy the episode. This is my story. I'm Megan Schaefer, and I'm recovering from 40 years of trying to fit into the very narrow definition I allowed myself of what is normal or what is acceptable, or for fuck's sake, just trying not to be that girl, whatever that means. And for the record, for all of you really accurate types like my husband, 40 years is just a good round number. I am 42, and I'm sure for the first couple of years I wasn't doing much more than attempting to walk and talk, so 40 is where I landed. While there's nothing about the first part of my life that I would call seamless or easy or even having gone as planned, I pretty much drilled it into the template I'd planned for. College, check. Job, check. Husband, check. Cute little pooches, check and check. But when it came to having a baby, well, that is when the shit show began. In 6 years, we lost 7 babies, and each one has its own dramatic story. I'm not going into all of them, don't worry. We would be here all day. But with a miscarriage, everybody's experience is a little different, and mine were never cut and dried. I don't think most of them are. They play out over days and sometimes weeks, and they're full of bathroom hostage situations and emergency room visits and needle sticks. I heard a whole lot of, "We aren't sure, we'll have to wait," before I would ever hear, "We must get you into surgery right away," or, "I'm sorry, there is no heartbeat." The first time I found out I was pregnant, I was in an urgent care center because I had just been diagnosed with the shingles. So I was 34, pregnant for the first time, and fighting with a doctor I didn't know over the drugs I was unwilling to take. My second pregnancy, I was so certain we'd already paid our debt to the gods of destruction and turmoil, I didn't even think to be concerned. On the other hand, by my fifth, "Oh fuck," were the first words out of my mouth when I saw the positive test. But not with my second. So I went to the first appointment alone while Jason was on a work trip in California. The plan ultimately was for me to meet him out there a few days later. But at that appointment, my ultrasound showed no baby on the monitor. And I waited for my doctor to do something to fix it, like hit a button or realize he didn't even have that part of the machine on. And when that didn't happen, all the air felt like it was sucked out of the room. And my doctor was saying words, lots of words. I'm sure it amounted to what was happening or what could be happening, but he just sounded like Charlie Brown's mother, like a bunch of want, want, want. I was so distracted by the thought of how could this be happening again. in order to determine if my pregnancy was viable or ectopic, which would mean it was growing outside of my uterus and, in my case, my tubes, I had to get a blood test. Well, two blood tests, actually, 48 hours apart to see if my numbers were rising properly. The doctor told me if they rose 60%, he would consider it viable. So 2 days later and 2 hours until my flight to California, I was told they rose 58%. I asked the doctor about worst case scenarios and he said, well, your tube might burst mid-flight. So my tube was likely a ticking time bomb, but I got on my flight anyway and just hoped like hell I was at least on the ground before it ruptured. But it never did. Not on my flight, not on our vacation, or even days later. When I did return and was officially diagnosed with an ectopic, I had the option of surgery to remove the tube or medication in an attempt to save it. And surgery felt aggressive and overly dramatic, and I hated being dramatic. So I chose to take a cancer drug called methotrexate that dissolved anything the body deemed foreign. So yeah, my body would deem my baby as foreign. I went on to have 2 more ectopics. My tubes burst on both occasions, and I needed emergency surgery because I was bleeding internally. I just recently found out this is actually the highest cause of maternal mortality. I'm so glad I didn't know that at the time. But I probably wouldn't have gotten on that plane. For the second one, neither Jason or I were working at the time. And we had just signed off on health insurance the week before after we'd gambled for a while without it. And the final one was in California and I didn't even have a doctor lined up yet. I laid in the ER terrified about who they were going to send in to operate on me. I didn't really have the luxury of choice due to where I was, the time of day, and the severity of my situation. It was 4 in the morning and we'd been in the ER since around 8:30. So Jason was afraid if he didn't get any sleep, he'd be shot at taking care of me the next day. But I begged him to stay until the doctor got there because I was too tired and in too much pain to advocate for myself. I knew I'd be way too nice and agreeable. I needed his bulldog personality to ask questions and say the hard things if it got to that point. We were lucky, though. My doctor was amazing. So now, since both of my tubes were gone, my only chance at pregnancy was IVF. We did 3 transfers at 2 different clinics. The first one was 2 weeks before we moved back to Missouri from California. So on our 4-day trip home, I had to wake up for my scheduled shots and we planned our route around the blood draws I needed. During IVF, my world revolved around the shots. They have to be taken at a specific time. So you initially choose the time, but once you make that choice, it is crucial that you are absolutely consistent. One of my doctors would only allow me a 15-minute window on either side of whatever time I chose. So I had to excuse myself from parties more than once. I took shots in the bathroom of an indoor soccer park prior to my games. 1 year for Jason's birthday, we did a hike-in camp, but I didn't have the ability to keep my meds cold, so I kept him in the car. I hiked to camp, set up, hiked back to the car at just the right time, and then back to camp. I got there right before it was pitch dark outside. But the craziest situation by far was at a dead stop on the highway due to a car accident. I couldn't exit, and I wasn't going to make it to my destination in time, so I had to give myself the shot in my car on the highway. The losses were excruciating, and I was in a perpetual state of fog. I was constantly preparing for or recovering from a physical situation, whether it was losing a baby or a procedure or a transfer. We'd barely have negotiated one event before we were in the middle of another one. There was no time to grieve. There was hardly even time to think. But nothing, nothing compared to the crisis of self I was having. See, being a mother was the only thing I was confident of. I was certain I was born to be a mother. And for most of my adult life, I was just waiting for this. I was buying time. I was waiting to be a mother so I could feel like I was putting some value into the world, so I could feel worthy and enough and like I belong somewhere. Which probably surprises a lot of people because I was the girl in high school involved in all the things and I was in a sorority in college and I had so many friends. But I never really felt like I belonged or fit. I'm sure there are lots of reasons for this, but I think the quickest answer is just that I didn't belong to myself. And motherhood was going to be my ticket out. But, and this is a really, really important but, it was also going to serve to help me continue to hide from my life, to just check boxes and feel like I was moving forward, like I was doing the next right thing, without really having any clue about who I was or what I wanted. I just wanted it to look good. I was more worried about looking like I was happy than I ever was about actually being happy. And here I was, the very foundation of all that I'd been chasing, all that I knew to be true, all my normal wrapped up in the prettiest fucking bow, blew up right in my face. It tore me up and it turned me inside out, over and over and over. And after each hit, I'd stitch myself back together, even though the pieces of me didn't fit at all. And I worked my ass off to go on living just as I had been before, riding myself, masking all my pain and all my scars, and mainly just attempting to create normalcy, because I thought that was the thing to do. Until I became so worn my stitches wouldn't hold. My defense mechanisms weren't working. The casual way I tossed aside or explained away the fact that we didn't have kids or that we were trying so I could sort of belong or at least have some kind of proximity to the group no longer carried the same carefree tone. I couldn't fake it. And at first, this is the part of the story most people don't know. At first, I wanted to withdraw further and more completely from the world. I didn't want to leave it. I wanted to stop being an active participant in my life and just kind of let it all wash over me, like be there, but not really be there. And I deeply contemplated this. I even planned on it for a little bit because it felt like breath and a space I could move within and a version of control that sometimes disguises itself as freedom. And I needed that so badly. I needed to be able to breathe, and I was tired. And I was truly to a point I didn't know how to be in my own life, and I imagined it. I imagined the self-sabotage, and I watched in my mind the total life destruction that would play out over time. And I was okay with it. I was like, yep, that's my plan. That's what I'm going for. I've always been really obsessed with being super reliable, like for doing what I said I was going to do at any cost. And most of the time that caused me to overcommit and say yes when I really meant no. But I think in this instance, it was finally working in my favor because I made a promise to do this life with someone, to be their person. And that promise meant I had to exhaust the only option I had left before totally calling it. I wrote a piece on my blog, mybeautifulcrazy.com, about hiking with shelter dogs and the time one slipped through the lead and got free. It was horrible. Even now, it makes my heart jump through my chest. But I got her back by doing the thing I was most terrified of, the thing that every part of me, out of fear, screamed not to do. But I'd tried all the safe, comfortable things, and the scariest thing, turning my back on her, sitting between parked cars and waiting, was the only trick I had left, and it worked. And it made me wonder now, what if the only salve to all of this pain, the only way to truly catch my breath, was the opposite of what I've been doing my whole life? That maybe the only right thing was also the scariest thing, but the only trick I had left. That maybe the thing to do was to stop stitching myself back together and live broken wide open. That deeply rooted in everything I was afraid of was where my freedom lived. What if I doubled down on this bullshit, leveraging not to be disconnected, but to be radically connected? What if I worked harder to understand what made people feel the otherness I was feeling? What if I started sitting with my loves when they were in pain, rather than helping them nullify it? What if I looked strangers in the eyes when I passed them and returned to them the feeling of, you are seen? I was terrified. But I was also out of options. Laura McCowan said it best. It slammed me into a wall of pain so thick I had to quit running. So accurate. But this whole radical connectedness, for it to work, it had to start with me. I had to become connected to myself. I had to become rooted in who I was. And I don't like bananas. Do you know I never said this to a person other than my husband because I was such a people pleaser? I mean, I don't totally hate bananas. So if I were in a situation where someone offered me a banana cream pie or banana cookies, I don't even know if those are a thing. I'd take them. I'd eat them. I didn't want to create a situation or make anyone feel bad. But now I'd vowed to stop betraying myself and to live true, even with the littlest things. So I was telling all the banana cream pie people, I don't fucking like bananas. By the way, I also don't like chocolate ice cream. I mean, travesty, I know. But I started saying the things I only thought and asking the questions I'd only wondered. And I was having the really hardest of hard conversations, the very ones I'd avoided my entire life. And most of them were with myself. I went to therapy for losing babies and realized I didn't just need therapy for losing babies because, guys, if you don't know this already, it's never the thing you know. It's always the thing you don't know. I needed to understand why not being a mother made me feel like a complete failure, or why I buried all of my value in it. I had to reinvent and reevaluate and unlearn. I had to find my worth in other places. And for any of you still looking for it, here's a hint. It's already there. You already are. Your worth cannot be lost, stolen, or taken. You're worthy because you are here, period. I want you to hear this. You are enough right now. I spent my whole life playing by the rules, defining my normal, and preparing. God, I was so overprepared for heartache and pain. I only ever took calculated risks. I went to the first college I got accepted to, and it was the only one I applied for. I only ever took jobs I knew I could do. Hell, when we started talking about kids, we bought an oversized SUV. Yes, when my tiny, ever-reliable VW was totaled in a hailstorm, we replaced it with an SUV twice the size because kids and dogs and camping. Kids were coming. That's what was next on our list in our suburban Midwest lives. And for kids, apparently you need abnormally large environment-sucking vehicles. We also researched schools and opened a savings account titled Children. Seriously. Hashtag so over fucking prepared. I stayed safe and small and quiet, thinking that was the way to avoid pain. And then I found myself failing miserably in the most unpredictable and uncontrollable way. I had been hiding, but the hard and the heartbreak found me anyway. Here's the thing. You can't hide from pain without hiding yourself from the world. And you can't hide from the world without hiding from yourself. You can't shrink from loss and fear and still extract joy. And you most definitely cannot walk around preoccupied with appearing all put together or normal and ever truly connect with people or even attempt to figure out you. I wouldn't change it. It took me so long to admit that out loud, long, long after it felt true and I knew it was, because it also felt like a betrayal to myself, but even more so to my husband, who held my hand while we army crawled our way through infertility. He supported me in ways he never knew would be necessary 10 years ago when we promised to do this life together. But still, I wouldn't change it. And I learned that the truth is not a betrayal. The truth is often much kinder than the stories we make up. And the truth is, we lost 7 babies, and it was so painful. And I decided to grab onto that pain and not let go until I spun it into something gold. And I did. I came home to myself and found peace and belonging. And the truth allowed me to grow in ways I never thought possible. Everything about who I am is so wrapped up in all of this. There's no way to pull apart one thread without undoing all of it. That's something I would never wish for. But I do want to use it. I believe we are entitled to everything that comes from our experiences and that we should extract every drop from them and use it to waste nothing. I want to be radically connected, and it's so rooted in understanding. I'm insanely curious about what things others have crawled their way out of, and I believe at some point we're all in a recovery of sorts. And I want to dig into other ideas of normal that are nothing more than fables, stories we've made up, which I think is mostly all of them. I'm sure there are things many of us consider exceptions that are normal to someone else, and things we consider normal that are totally exceptions to somebody else, because most of us, like me, only see the tiny island we live on. The reality is, I'm not special because this terrible thing happened to me. Terrible things happen to people all the time. We're all scared. We all feel other for different reasons. We all deal with things that are typical in our micro world that are unfathomable to someone else, because there really isn't a normal. And feeling like there might be, that normal is actually a status or an arrival point, feels so comforting. Like if we can just get there, if we can just check all the boxes, but that place doesn't exist. Throw out the checklist. Let the most wild or unfathomable thing about your life become the most beautiful, stop trying to be normal and start being real. I'm still learning this. And if you're anything like me, it's going to be a process. I'm still peeling the onion. I'm not good at it yet. So this is what I'm offering. All my questions, my challenging of the lens I've lived through, finding wholeness and humanity and the idea that there are no rules and that we need to color outside the lines and allow others to do the same, embracing curiosity and discovery and exposure over judgment and ignorance. Brené Brown reminds us, it's hard to hate up close, so let's get close. This is me on a journey, a quest to understand, to have authentic, curious, brave, and at times, a little bit uncomfortable conversations. Yeah, it might get awkward. Brace yourself. But I can't imagine I'm the only one who needs this right now. So tell me what you've always wanted to know, but were too afraid to ask. Tell me what you wish the world better understood, but were too afraid to say. What's the illusion of normal you want to shatter? Thank you for listening. Let's keep this conversation rolling. For questions and comments, find us on Facebook, Instagram at Dismantling Normal. Visit our website, dismantlingnormal.com, for the show notes and extra links. See you next time. Have a great day, guys.